Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, August 31st edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and also available via podcast. More about that during the second half of the show. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with Anna Solomon and her new novel, Leaving Lucy Pear. But first up, writer Dana Johnson. Dana is the author of Break Any Woman Down, winner of the Flannery O'Connor Award for short fiction, and the novel Elsewhere, California. Her work has appeared in the Paris Review, Callaloo, the Iowa Review, among others, and anthologized in Watchlist, 32 Stories by Persons of Interest, Shaking the Tree, a collection of new fiction and memoir by Black women, and California Uncovered, Stories for the 21st Century. She's a professor of English at the University of Southern California, and her new book is a collection of short stories called In the Not Quite Dark, and it's published by Counterpoint Press. I'm so pleased to have her on the show this morning. Good morning, Dana.
Hi, good morning. Thanks, Nicole.
Let's start off by having you introduce your book to us. Would you tell us about the collection?
Okay, so it's a collection of, I'm forgetting how many stories there are. There are
11?
11 or so stories. And a lot of the stories are set downtown where I've lived since 2005. And I was just interested in the changes, the gentrification, just what it is to live in one place in a decade and seeing all the changes and what creates or consists of community here downtown. Not all the stories are downtown-based, but a lot of them are.
Yeah, I was interested because Los Angeles is a common, although not, as you point out, universal element in the stories, but you were born there, you grew up there, and now you're a professor there. And so in terms of gaining the perspective to examine it, how did you achieve that distance?
I don't know if it's just a writer thing, but I can't help but be observant no matter where I am. And so in that way, even though I'm living in the middle of something, there's something always new about it or something always compelling about place. So for me, I never feel, it doesn't necessarily feel familiar all the time, if that makes sense. I'm living here, I've lived here my whole life, but I'm always looking at California, Los Angeles, or wherever it is that I happen to be traveling. I was in Cuba earlier this summer. I'm always looking at it through the lens of a writer, and my background in college was journalism, print journalism, so that kind of view informs my writing as well, that kind of documentary and observational writing.
Would you read to us from the book?
Sure. I would love to read from a story called The Story of Biddy Mason, who was a slave who walked all the way from Mississippi and to San Bernardino, California, with her master, Robert Smith, who was Mormon. And she eventually gained her freedom and amassed a fortune of $300,000, which, of course, was quite a bit at the time. It's a story that actually contrasts Biddy Mason's life story with that of Henry Edward Huntington of Huntington Beach, Huntington Library. And he also built the building that I live in here downtown, Pacific Electric Lofts. He brought trains and the red cars to Los Angeles. And so I was interested in contrasting and comparing one life that's mostly well-known to Californians and Los Angelinos with that of Biddy Mason, who is not so well-known to Los Angelinos and Californians. And she was a philanthropist and did a great deal for Los Angeles. So I'll just read a little bit from that story. Before tracks were laid, before Huntington was born in 1848, Biddy Mason walked 1,700 miles west behind a 300-wagon caravan all the way from Mississippi, stopping in Utah for 3 years or so before finally setting foot in San Bernardino with her master and 150 wagons. 2 years before Huntington was born, 72 years after his relative put his timid or humble signature on a document that declared it self-evident that all men were created equal, well, of course, the devil was in the details. All those important men in the room with their signatures on paper, so much brilliance and vision and blindness, men. Biddy didn't know it as she walked behind oxen, avoiding the piles they dropped because, for now, they were only on their way to Utah. But in California, the one word men would open the gate that confused young Huntington. It was so gaping and yawning and wide. Biddy, though, she would know exactly what to do once she came upon that unfathomable thing called choice. First, though, she walked. She took her first step behind the wagon caravan, thinking of all the things she would have to do along the way. She would have to deliver all the babies that would be born across the plains and the desert. She would have to herd the oxen and cook the meals, set up and break down camp. Plus, she had her own little ones, all daughters, 10 and 4, and the new one, who had only been in the world for months and would not remember what it was like to be a slave. She would have to take care of them, but not as well as she would have to take care of all the others in the caravan. Master Smith placed a hand on her shoulders, and it had felt too warm as the sun was already ablaze in the dewy morning. He told her all the things she knew already. You ready for this journey, Biddy? It will be a long one. See to it that you care for Mr. Smith above all. Because he was called by God, because he believed in the Mormon Church, they were going west.
Thank you.
And I should say that her master, Robert Smith, was warned not to take his slaves to California because slavery was illegal in California. And so that's part of how Biddy gains her freedom, because they come west. And that's the beginning of her life here in California.
Hmm. That was Dana Johnson reading from her new collection of short stories in The Not Quite Dark, published by Counterpoint. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And as I listened to you read that story, I don't know why this thought came into my head, but there's a good balance in the collection between first-person perspectives and third-person. And so in that story, did you ever toy with first-person?
No, not at all, because I wanted to have a breath of history, and I kind of wanted to have a voice that felt omniscient so that I can go anywhere that I wanted to go. I could go to where Huntington was a young man trying to make a name for himself here out west. I could be with Biddy in the desert. I could be with Biddy and Pio Pico having lunch here downtown near Alvera Street. So first person wouldn't have served my goal there, to have that kind of breath and historic scope.
Mm-hmm. And the breadth of history that you mention, there is a sense of history, I think, in each of the stories. And I thought that was interesting because of the Los Angeles setting. And I wondered if that was in any way intentional because of this, I don't know, belief out there that Los Angeles doesn't have any history or it's so new.
Absolutely. I think most Los Angelinos who live here understand that there's just as much history here as there is anywhere else. But I wanted to talk about the history and the layers of histories. And I live here downtown on Main Street in what is called the Historic Core, in a building that was built in 1905. And so I'm always looking at the building, feeling the history in my own hallways and thinking about all the people who lived here before me and who will live here after me. It's just, I feel that history and I feel the past. And so, thank you for saying that, because I think that's exactly right. Nearly all the stories address history, personal history, in some way.
Yeah, I enjoyed when the characters went there in their thoughts because it made me, see the city differently. And there's a review in Publishers Weekly, which is really positive, but I cringed just a little bit when they said, this is essential reading for Angelenos, Californians, and anyone interested in masterly, morally engaged storytelling. But if you substitute New York for that, this is essential reading for New Yorkers, I don't think it works. And so do you feel pigeonholed as an LA writer, or what's it like these days to be a writer from LA?
I do feel that there used to be more pigeonholing of Los Angeles writers, but less so these days because we have folks like Robin Koss-Lewis, who was born and raised in Compton, winning the National Book Award, or my colleague at USC, Viet Nguyen, winning the Pulitzer Prize. And people like Janet Fitch and, of course, T.C. Boyle and any other number of Los Angeles writers, I think, doing what we need to do, which is just write. And I do think that people are paying attention. But on the other hand, I do think that still there's a sense in publishing that somehow New York is more universal and everyone else is niche or something. You know, I get that. I do feel that sometimes. So, but the other thing is, I think what I do like about that Publishers Weekly review is the idea that perhaps I got something new down on the page that perhaps some Los Angelenos were not aware of. And so, I like that idea of that somehow there's some sort of new information about Los Angeles within the collection that readers might not know about. So that I will take. That I was happy about.
And having been an Angeleno all your life, you mentioned the authors, the long list of authors now who hail from Los Angeles who are getting recognition. But in terms of the more broad literary scene in LA, have you noticed differences or changes?
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand in terms of the broader scene. What do you mean?
Oh, I mean, just in terms of events and community and discussions and the climate for writers.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like there's something going on every single day, every month. I'm exhausted. I can't get to everything. There's so many great things going on, and I can't seem to be at all these places at once, but I want to be, and I really appreciate that community. I feel like actually the writing world is quite small in LA, but having said that, it's big. I feel like I run into people that know people that I know, I didn't know. It's just like it's big and small at the same time, if that makes sense. I should say it's like a deep community. Even when you think you're just meeting some one or two people, suddenly you're connected to 20 or 30 people. So I really like that about the culture and the climate in terms of writing here in LA.
And turning to craft now, one of your strengths is establishing tension in a story. And I like the way you explore the tension, and sometimes it leads in an unexpected direction. Like in the Liberace Museum, the tension shifts a couple of times, but it carries us through. And so I then began to wonder, how do you look at tension as an author? Do you have to make an explicit effort to establish it, or is that more, does it just kind of emerge for you?
I am trying to figure out how to create the tension, and I usually think about the unexpected, and it's the unexpected moment that usually concerns a reader or intrigues a reader or disturbs a reader. And so I think in that story, I have a couple moments of reversals or a zag when you think I'm going to zig, if you will, so that helps create the tension. For example, I think earlier in the story, Charlotte says that Heath doesn't have a sense of humor. And so by the time we get to the end of the story, I don't want to give it away, but by the time you get to the end of the story, and Heath finds something humorous that Charlotte does not, that is sort of the payoff of all of that tension, or even just creating that rift between them in the moment. And so I knew I was going to do that, that if someone has said, for example, not to have a sense of humor beginning of the story, that somehow that has to pay off later in a way that is unexpected, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I'm talking to writer Dana Johnson. Her new collection of short stories is In the Not Quite Dark. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And one, another craft issue that I wanted to pick your brain about is, so in No Blaming the Harvard Boys, the protagonist is grading essays. And then she starts to do an internet search for her old friends, and she finds a photo of one with her husband in front of their house. And about that, she says she's glad her friend avoided cliche in the way her husband appeared. And she says, "We ran from cliche in grad school. That was the worst thing anyone could say about you. And so the more we tried to not be typical, the more we were, of course." So she's not talking about writing here, but it made me think about it. And so as a writer, how do you deal with cliches? Do you censor them starting in the first draft, or do you do a cliche edit later? Or
I mean, I try to avoid them from the very beginning. So if I write a sentence down and it looks like something I've seen before, I just try again. And if that second thing seems too familiar as well, I try again. And, you know, I'm not sure that I avoid cliche completely. It's just what every writer should avoid. But I do. I think about something that's overly familiar, for instance, I do think, and not to talk badly about my own work, but I was just thinking, in the Liberace Museum, there's a line, "still as a statue." I might write that differently now, you know, that "still as a statue" I think is too familiar, but maybe I should have crossed that sentence out and dug a little deeper for another kind of image. But I'm always working at that, yes. Definitely.
And the kind of cliche that this woman is worried about, you know, the more, I don't know, life level or image level. I'm asking because I find myself tripping into these things, and then when they become clear, being so mortified. And so do you worry about those kinds of cliches too, or like the story level ones?
You mean like maybe in terms of subject matter, where something's been told before, or
yes, or a certain kind of character that's too given?
Absolutely. I'm always worried about that too, and I'm hoping that in the night quite dark, not quite dark, that, I don't know, it's a hard challenge as a writer because you're trying to write people that seem familiar to the reader, familiar in that they are actual human beings, even though they're just sort of words on the page that you're crafting into a character, that you want to feel that connection and recognize them as a person or people. But at the same time, you can't write a flat character. You can't write a character that we think we've seen before unless you do something else with it. So I'm always thinking about that, just how to make the story new. Because, you know, the cliche is all the stories have been told, and they have been, so you just have to figure out how am I talking about this character in a way that's true and real and somehow surprising all at the same time.
In your acknowledgments, you mention a nice group of LA writers that you call your readers. And I'm wondering what kind of exchanges you have with them. Do you exchange entire manuscripts, or how do you navigate your exchanges?
It's been a great group. And, you know, these are all other Los Angeles writers. I hate to say Los Angeles writers because they're just writers, but I really admire their work. Victoria Patterson, who wrote Drift and The Snake in Paradise, and Danzy Senna and Sarah Bynum. So we try to meet regularly, but it ends up being irregularly just because we all have lives. And we just sort of give each other whatever we have. So we haven't met in the last, we didn't really meet so much this summer, but when we meet, we usually meet every 2 weeks. And whoever has pages just gives those pages, and we read them. And that's, they helped me finish Elsewhere, California. And a lot of books have been written in that group since we started maybe 7 years ago. And so, yeah, it's kind of low pressure, just who has something. Send it in, and then we just talk about it. And they're really great, just, you know, for the honesty, if this is cliche or this seems too familiar, or I actually have no idea what you're doing, Dana. What is this? So it's just great to have readers who respect me as a writer and respect the work, but who also are not above just giving it to me straight about what I need to do, which I think all writers need. I think for me, it's always helpful to have other eyes on the work. And so I don't think I'm the kind of writer, even after all these years, who can just read something and think it's good to go without somebody giving it a pass, be it my editor or a counterpoint or whomever. It's just great to have other eyes.
Thank you for calling me out on the Los Angeles writers thing. I can't. it's mixed bag because I'm proud that they're from Los Angeles, but at the same time, you're right. They are just writers, and we shouldn't label.
Yeah, no, it's really. I think it comes from wanting to assert that yes, people are writing here in Los Angeles. So you want to say that, but on the other hand. Yeah, we're just writers, and there's somebody writing in Nebraska, and there's someone writing in Montana, and they're not called Montana writers. We're just all writers. So, yeah, I try to avoid that if I can.
I'm talking to writer Dana Johnson. Her new collection of short stories is In the Not Quite Dark. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And I know, or I've heard, that short story collections are hard to publish. So how did this one come together? How were you able to get it out there?
I'm lucky enough to have been published by Counterpoint Press. They published Elsewhere, California, and my editor for that book was Dan Smetanka, who is now the vice president of Counterpoint and the executive editor at Counterpoint. And so I have a working relationship with him, and I had these stories brewing. Some of them have been published previously. For instance, the Liberace Museum was published in 2005 when there still existed the Liberace Museum. It's no longer there in Las Vegas, but I was lucky enough to get there before it closed. But anyway, a lot of these stories had been placed elsewhere, and I told Dan I had these stories, and he said I would really like to see them, and he loved them and had me write 4 or 5 more stories to complete the collection, and Counterpoint then published them, lucky for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dana, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, do you have any writing advice maybe for our short story writers?
I happen to love the short story form, and it's my jam, as the kids say. So I think, for one thing, this idea of whether or not short stories sell is, should be irrelevant to a writer. If that's what you're feeling, if that's what you want to do, then you should write the short story and not think, well, let me write the novel first and then I'll see about short stories. If short stories is what you have, then that's what you do. That's, if those are the stories you have to tell at the moment, that's what you should do. And I'm so glad that some of these stories were happening where I was writing while I was writing Elsewhere, California, because that was my first novel. which I found difficult to write, but I was so missing the short story form that I would speak and write a short story whenever I could. And so that was me being true to sort of what I needed at the time, writing the novel, yes, which was difficult and which I still ended up enjoying having written, not writing, if that makes sense. But the stories are the thing that I turned to for kind of just peace of mind. So that's what I would say. If that's what you want to do, you stick with that.
Mm. Well, Dana, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. This was great.
That was Dana Johnson, author of the new collection of short stories, In the Not Quite Dark, published by Counterpoint. During the second part of the show, author Anna Solomon will be here, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter at WOWKUCIFM. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. On the first part of the show, I spoke with writer Dana Johnson. Next up, author Anna Solomon. Anna is the author of The Little Bride and a two-time winner of the Pushcart Prize. Her short fiction essays and reviews have appeared in publications including The New York Times Magazine, One Story, Plowshares, Slate, The Boston Globe, and more. And she is co-editor with Eleanor Henderson of Labor Day, True Birth Stories by Today's Best Women Writers. Her new novel is Leaving Lucy Pear, published by Viking. And I am so pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Anna.
Hi, thank you for having me.
To start us off, could you introduce the book to us?
Sure. So Leaving Lucy Pear is the story sort of at its center of three women, one who abandons a baby and the other who raises that baby, and then the third is the baby herself, who's 10 years old by the time that the book takes place, which is in 1927. So it's 10 years after the abandonment, and it's the summer where these three women are brought back together, sort of not due to their own doing, but the sort of cast of other characters who manage to bring them back together without really meaning to.
How did you decide on the 1920s as the setting for this novel?
Well, I was drawn to it initially, I think in the way that a lot of people are, sort of the glamorous sort of flappers and the big bands and the kind of all of these images I had, many of which are true. But as I researched and as I dug into it and sort of realized how complicated and dark the decade was, politically especially, it was really a decade of extremes. In the wake of World War One, there was this huge wave of xenophobia that spread across the country. White supremacists were, on the rise. The Ku Klux Klan numbers were skyrocketing. And there was this real hunt on for communists. It was this very, there was also a huge divide during this decade between the labor movement and industrialists, which you kind of saw culminate in the execution in the summer of 1927, which is the summer the book takes place, of the Italian-American anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti. So it was a really kind of rich decade and full of the kinds of contradictions that both, make for excellent, not really backdrop, but sort of the world of a novel, and also resonated in a lot of ways with where we are today.
Right. But so that's interesting. So the setting actually came first?
It's one of those things that really came together for me. This mm-hmm. character, Beatrice Haven, who is, leaves her baby when she's 17 years old. She's this Jewish socialite in Boston, Massachusetts, and very part of a very assimilationist Jewish family. They are industrialists. And I didn't know exactly when it would be set at first. I think that grew sort of as I came to understand her, and then as I understood, that would be on the sort of the dawn of United States entrance into World War One. I think that it really grew as the plot grew, because then I understood, the person who got her pregnant was a lieutenant, and he was about to head off and become an admiral. It's very symbiotic for me, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, in terms of the relationship between the characters and the time period and the plot. And they can't, it's really hard to kind of parse which one came first, because they have to grow together.
Mm. And once you got a grasp of that storyline, did you outline or did you just start writing?
I do a lot of outlines. I mean, I start to write right away because that's sort of what gets me into the story, but pretty quickly I start to try to figure out, well, what is this story going to be? Where is it heading? And I do a lot of outlining on, like, huge rolls of paper, you know, like the big, like you can get at IKEA, you know, or elsewhere, like big rolls of paper, kind of spread it all out on the floor and draw these kind of arcs. And often it's sort of by character, and just kind of really I need to visually see the shape of the book. It changes a lot as I write, so often, you know, I'll return to that outline maybe, you know, 6 months or a year later and see that half of it is totally evolved and can't work anymore. But I like to have something there for me to kind of keep the faith.
In finding one's rhythm, I think that's one of the key things. And you wrote an interesting essay in The Millions about maternal abandonment in literature.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, you say that you try not to overthink your first drafts. But do you think that the outlining helps you not overthink it, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. It's funny. I think the overthinking for me has more to do with the sort of like, well, what does it all mean? And what am I trying to, you know, how does it all... What are the themes I'm working with? In that way, I try to kind of stay a little bit dumb through the beginning, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm not aware of the plot, if you know what I mean. So for me, I do want to have a pretty strong sense of the story itself. But in terms of sort of the resonances and the parallels and how it's all going to come together, a lot of that doesn't happen for me until, you know, the second and third and tenth drafts when I have my story and then I'm asking, well, what is this? What does this mean, and how is it going to work, and does this part need to be here at all? And those kinds of the things that can kind of get you tripped up in the first draft from writing at all, or at least can get me tripped up.
So, Anna, would you read to us from your book?
Yeah, I'm going to read from the first chapter, these heads, then I won't have to explain too much of what comes before. So this is on page 4 of the book, and this is Beatrice Haven. Through the near trees, she could see the far ones in the orchard down below. Slowly, her eyes adjusted, and she saw the pears themselves, their waxy orbs glowing greenly in the three-quarter dark. Her mouth watered, and Bee, embarrassed by this bodily secretion, turned her thoughts to her plan. Walk to the orchard, wake infant, nurse infant, change infant, check inside paper sack, extra diapers, 2 bottles, 4 cans of Borden's evaporated milk, 5 $20 bills, set infant under most plentiful tree, run. Around her left wrist on a leather cord, Bee wore the very loud whistle Aunt Vera used to scare squirrels off the bird feeders. If they weren't gentle with the infant, she would blow it. Also, she would blow it if they turned out not to be who she thought they were. Bee had relied on Uncle Ira for her information, and Uncle Ira was prone to telling tales. Nevertheless, Bee had chosen to believe him. It happened every year, he said, when the moon was bright enough to see by but not to be easily seen, the air still enough not to carry sound or scent, the pears on the verge of starting to drop. He never heard or saw a thing, but the next morning he would look out his window and down the hill, and there, where the day before the pears had packed the branches like sparrows, there would be only leaves and the gray, fleshy stubs from which the pears had grown. Uncle Ira smiled, describing this. They might be giraffes, he mused, giants. Ira harbored a kind of love for the trespassers who stole his pears. They made him feel benevolent. But really, he said, Catholics, a poor Irish family who'd found a market for pears, and Bee believed him, maybe because she had to. She didn't know any Catholics. Catholics weren't Jews, but they were like Jews in that they weren't Protestants, so there was that. And back home, Bee had seen the Irish children walking in packs through the common and envied them, even the poor ones, the company. There looked to be a certain freedom in being one of many, the right to go unnoticed, unattended. Neglect, Bee's mother would call it, she who had rarely let Bee out of her sight, until she had, quite suddenly, and look at the consequences. Bee began to walk. Her neck was wet with the baby's breath, and to counter the sensation and whatever emotion it might lead to, she did what she had trained herself to do over the months of carrying the baby, as rigorously as she had ever trained herself to play a Beethoven sonata or pen a thank you card in the microscopic, finger-cramping script that satisfied her mother. She thought of other things, the pear trees, which she could see more clearly with every step. B tightened her hold on the bundle of baby and shawl. She had reached the stone wall that marked the orchard's western boundary. She squinted into the dark, straining to hear the first sounds of feet and wheelbarrows, but heard nothing apart from the lazy slap of water on the rocky beach down below. The pears waited on their branches. So I'll stop there. But as you can see, that's the scene, sort of the book opens with the scene in 1917 where she leaves this baby that she had a couple weeks before, and Emma Murphy, the mother of this large Irish Catholic family, finds and takes the baby. And that's the beginning of the book. And then it jumps forward, the rest of the book jumps forward to 1927, 10 years later.
Thank you. That was Anna Solomon reading from her new novel, Leaving Lucy Pear, published by Viking. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And the beginning, sometimes beginnings are tricky, but in this case, was the beginning obvious to you? I bet it didn't change much as you were working on the rest, or is that wrong?
Yeah, no, this beginning really was there from the beginning, which, as you know, sometimes that's not the case. But it was sort of, I knew that this was where the book had to start. And, I was open to the idea that maybe I'd get to the end of the book and realize that I needed to start somewhere else. But it always seemed, and this is this moment that begins the whole thing, and where you see these characters kind of in a very, except for B, I mean, B, you sort of get deeply into her point of view in this first chapter, but you don't, you see Emma Murphy, for instance, as really from the outside, and then you see this baby, obviously, from the outside, and these are characters who later you get to know really well in the novel and understand, you know, what Emma was doing there in the orchard and why she took Lucy and what has happened. She named the baby Lucy Pear, which is obviously the name of the book is Leaving Lucy Pear, and that's the name that this Irish family gives this baby. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the beginning was really there from the start.
And in terms of research to get the essence of the era, what kind of research did you have to do to get those details?
Oh, I mean, I did all of the things you would expect in terms of, you know, old newspapers and advertisements and history books and kind of all of the typical things. And then, you know, the best part was really talking with people. I grew up in Gloucester, Massachusetts, which is where this book is set, and was lucky enough to have, you know, a way to kind of find people who mostly were not alive during this time, but either, you know, grandson of a bootlegger who remembered, because Prohibition, we haven't talked about, was going on during this time, and so there's moonshine and rum running going on in the book, and, you know, he remembered, hear his grandfather talking about how they would blow these caves out of the quarry walls where they could store the liquor, and sort of gardens where the whole garden, if you dug down like 3 inches, was just told all underneath the dirt was all booze. And you know, there was one old woman who had written a lot about the quarries as well. She was a writer, and she was able to talk to me about sort of what it was like to be a kid at that time and walking on the granite paths in your bare feet and what that felt like, and those kinds of, you know, sensory details that you can't get in a history book. So I really do love talking to people who have expertise. It always leads to something that I wouldn't find in another way.
Yeah, the Prohibition details are fun, and that the extent to which people go to hide the liquor on islands, and yeah. and the Perry too, I was intrigued by. It made me want to go out and find a bottle because I'd never heard of it, and the liquor that they
make it's this pear, sort of pear wine, pear cider that I had discovered long, you know, I was studying in England during college and came, you know, I think it was in Sussex, there was Perry. It's sort of, I think, more common in Britain than here, but it sort of came back to me, and what's amazing is that, so that's what they're making in the book, they're trying to make Perry illegally and, you know, for a profit, and I found out recently that a woman I grew up with who has kind of taken over, become sort of the matriarch of this orchard here on Cape Ann, Massachusetts, that they are in fact making Perry. And so I did get a whole bunch of bottles, and I was bringing them around to my readings and such. But so it was really amazing because the Perry was not only being made, but it was being made on the, you know, on the soil where this book is set.
Emma, the woman whose idea it is to set up the Perry shop, she's a mother of nine, and she makes sacrifices for her family. She's a complicated woman because she's sort of a victim in some ways, but also a victimizer. And how did you go about developing her as a character?
I did I, you know, developed her in the way that I develop most of my characters, which is sort of as I write her, as I, you know, I really discover who my characters are as I put them in scenes and make them act and see how they act, which isn't to say that they're in control. I mean, I know that some people, writers, you know, will say that they feel very much like their characters just start doing things that they would never have expected, but more just that I don't really know who they are until I see what happens when I put them in scenes with other characters, and then I have to, you know, think, well, how is this going to work with the plot? And is it, so again, it's the symbiotic process. But I didn't know, you know, for instance, at the beginning that Emma was going to be having an affair, which was a very, you know, really, really sinful thing for a woman of her generation and her, you know, being an Irish Catholic mother of nine, you know, a really different thing. I had to really understand what that would have meant for her versus sort of somebody that, you know, somebody now or a different type of person. So a lot of the development of her character happened with writing her, happened with my research, happened with, you know, giving the book to an Irish Catholic friend who grew up in this huge family and saying, like, can you read Emma for me and tell me, you know, what am I getting wrong? What am I getting right? And that was incredibly helpful. But it took a long time, and kept kind of, she just kept evolving as the book kept evolving.
And tied to characterization is the voice of the novel. And about that, Maggie Shipstead in her New York Times review said about your characters, there's an agreeably old-fashioned forthrightness to the way Solomon crafts those characters. They are who she tells us they are, which is not to say the novel is without surprises. And her phrase, old-fashioned forthrightness, I really felt that. And so I wanted to ask you about the voice here. How did you, is that just the voice that came naturally, or how did you go about crafting that?
Yeah, it came both naturally and with a lot of effort. So there was this sort of, I did decide when I started to write it with this omniscient narrative voice, so sort of in the more style of like a Dickensian novel, where the narrator is, you know, God in a sense, and can and knows everything and can dip into anybody's mind. That I think of her as she, because I'm she, but that she wants to, you know. And so there's this great freedom in it. At first it just felt like really, really fun, and then I had to get it under control, because I was also, you know, you still have to figure out, like, well, where is which character, what am I trying to say, you know, like where does each character need to be the one that we're closest to? Where does the narrator, the narrative kind of draw out in that way where you can, it sort of gives you this broad sweep of what's going on with different characters in different places. The rhythm of the narration and the pacing, I mean, which is always important no matter what you're writing, but I found with the omniscient narrator was especially tricky to get right and took a lot of drafts to figure out sort of where do I go in close, where do I draw out. The very first page of the book, the first paragraph is a very close third person with B, and then in the second paragraph, suddenly you see that the narrator knows a lot more than B. And at first, that was something I was taking on sort of in an experimental way, I think, I just really wanted to try it out. And as I wrote the book, I had to really grapple with and figure out, did it in fact, you know, did it make sense for this book? And what I think I was feeling instinctually at first, excuse me, and later came to understand on a more sort of analytical level, was that the book is so much about how this one girl, unbeknownst to her really, has this enormous impact on the lives of, excuse me, not only her two mothers, the woman, you know, who birthed her and the woman who's raised her, but also on this host of other characters, some of whom only really meet her glancingly, but others of whom get to know her, and kind of the way that this one person, you know, relatively small person, that the kind of like the ripple effect of her existence and the secret of her as well. So I think that the way in which it really is about a community, the omniscient narrator allowed me to capture that.
And also crucial to the story are some coincidences. And I'm asking this question, to be honest, it's kind of personal, because I think coincidences in fiction are a tool that I haven't mastered. And so from where you are, do you remember like playing with it, or did you have any How do you use coincidences?
So tell me, like, what's an example here that you would call, you mean like where that Josiah Story, the manager of the quarry, is bringing Emma to work for B, that kind of thing?
Exactly, yeah. And so B ends up getting a job. Oh, excuse me, Emma ends up getting a job in B's house, which, you know, it's necessary, it's compelling, and it's tight, you know, and so...
I think that mainly I try to create, I do think about it a lot, and I had to go back, and there were different, actually, opinions about the particular scene where he offers her that job, and certain readers and editors who felt that, you know, that he should offer her a few jobs and have that one be the one she chose, and that would make it feel sort of more... Anyway, there were different opinions about what would make it... It was interesting, and people had very different, really different feelings about what would make it feel, like, less coincidental and more... Or more coincidental, but they totally clashed. And so I wound up just having to really make the choice on my own. I think the key to me is really making sure that whatever is happening, that it's necessary for all the characters before they come into that moment of sort of serendipity, before it all comes together, that the characters are each their character and their circumstances and the pressures on them and their the conflicts in their lives are developed in order to make that moment be necessary, so that it isn't just out, it's not like a spaceship landing. That's sort of how I work on things like that. So that there is that, you know, Josiah Story is running for mayor and wanting to get, you know, that there's a lot of, what am I trying to say, motivation and a lot at stake for each of the characters in those moments, so that they aren't purely, don't feel, hopefully, purely coincidental. I think it's always about going back, like working backwards and saying, so how do I get them to this moment so that it does feel necessary and hopefully even, inevitable.
Mm-hmm. I understand that you wrote poetry before writing fiction.
I did, yeah.
And I wasn't surprised when I read that, but can you talk about transitioning to fiction and how the poetry, you know, lives on in your fiction?
Yeah. It was such a hard transition. It was one that I don't know why I knew it. I just have suddenly, like, I need to be writing stories, but I found the actual laying down of words, like articles and, to feel really ugly at first, like these sentences, they're so clunky, you know, compared to the minimalism and the sort of just poetry. And someone put it well to me recently. She called it tolerating the ordinary. It felt like that, like what writing prose is compared to writing poetry. But I also loved it, and I knew that what I wanted to do was to tell stories. I think that one of the ways that it has definitely stayed with me is that I, you know, as I write, I hear everything I am writing. I don't speak out loud as I'm writing. That would drive people crazy because I work in a shared writing space. But I do, like, it's all totally oral for me as I'm writing. And so the rhythms are essential, and it very much does kind of come out of that, I think, come out of my early experience with poetry.
Can you talk really quickly about that shared writing space and how that works?
Yeah, it's in Brooklyn. It's called the Brooklyn Writers Space. A lot of people in the city, including myself, don't have any space in their own apartments to work in. So there are, you know, quite a number throughout the city of these shared writing spaces where you go each day and, you know, you pay a membership fee and you go and you grab a different desk each day. It's totally silent. And there's, you know, there is like a lounge area where people talk, and so you meet people, and it's a community built through it too. But it's just a great way to be able to know that you have this really quiet, devoted space to your work.
Mm-hmm. And we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, do you have any writing advice for the writers listening?
Well, I've been talking recently, and people seem to be loving it, so I will share it here about this Post-it note that I keep around me, which says, "You will fail," which sounds like really counterintuitive and not what you'd want to tell people. But the reason it's so great for me when I'm working on something, especially if I'm feeling like this has to be perfect, I can't write another line because this is not working, is it just frees you up because you know that you're going to fail and that the first draft and probably the second and third are going to need so much more work. So you might as well just get it down. And so it helps, it really motivates me, as strange as that may seem, and just frees me up to fail because you're going to. So that's my advice. A Post-it.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was fun.
That was Anna Sullivan, author of the new novel, Leaving Lucy Pear, published by Viking. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, Marie will be on to talk with young adult author Nora Riley Baskin and short story writer Alexander Weinstein. Stay tuned for Suspended on Silver Wings, Moon Pop with DJ Uni B, coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.